Blog Talk Radio.
Politics live from Shelley's back room in the heart of Washington, D.C. You're used to hearing the cold opening that I normally do announcing our topics for the day, but unfortunately today we're having a little bit of a problem with Skype.
What? Again?
I know, a shocker, a shocker. Here's the funny thing about it is we can attribute it to the fact that today one of the news items coming out of Wall Street was that Skype has been bought for $8.3 billion by Microsoft. So it's a Microsoft issue now. So guess what, kids? We're going to be doing this in the blind for a few minutes until we get Blog Talk Radio to give us a heads up on what the possible issues might be. This is Backroom Politics, as we stated before. With me, as he is every Tuesday, is the former eight-term member of Congress from Washington's 2nd District. He is the former vice president of Burlington Northern Railroad for Government Affairs. He is the Honorable Al Swift. Al, welcome.
Welcome. We're a little lonely today.
We are a little lonely today because joining us by phone, I believe, from the 203 area code, is our resident Hawaiian, our international affairs expert, Dr. Ralph Winnie, who is somewhere out in the middle of the Pacific on one of the Hawaiian islands. Ralph, if you can hear us, we're doing this in the blind. So, mahalo, my brother. Stay tuned. Stay with us. We'll have you on here shortly. And also noticeably missing is the former staffer for Gerald R. Ford. He is the former vice president for government affairs for NBC, Bob Hines. He is noticeably absent. I believe he is on vacation in the Big Apple.
Actually, he is attending a kind of a reunion of NBC people.
That's right. This is the former NBC executives reunion week, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's right. Well, obviously, there's a lot going on here in the nation's capital, so we'll get right to it. The topic's still on everybody's mind. There's actually two topics this week. The big topic this week on everybody's mind has been the political fallout and the political backlash of the Bin Laden operation, but we're going to talk about that a little bit later in the show because I want to get Ralph's input on the international effects on that.
Right.
But what we are going to start off by talking about is what has been leading a lot of the talking head shows over the past day has been the economy again. The economy continues to run headlines here in the nation's capital. And what we've got is a situation where we are now paying on an average, a national average, $4 a gallon for gasoline. I just filled up my car this morning. It cost me $65 to fill up my car, which is unheard of. It's a Toyota. It shouldn't cost me $65 to fill up a Bentley, and it's costing me that to fill up a Toyota. The issue is there's so many issues associated with this, Al, and no one seems to be able to get a grasp on what's going on and why this is happening. Al, you're a former member of Congress. You've been around big oil. I know that they talked to you on several occasions while you were a senior member.
I had four refineries in my district.
On top of that, you did have four refineries in your district. My question to you is Congress, when you were seated as a member of Congress, did you ever get the feeling that there had to be tighter restrictions or tighter regulatory effects on not just how big oil operated, but more so on the aspect of pricing and how the pricing is determined?
Well, the answer is yes, but it's much more complicated than that. First of all, I tend to distrust anything that is so big that it can pretty much do what it wants, and so I tend to favor some reasonable regulation. But the other thing is I had more than once, executive after executive, I've had guys at the refineries themselves try and explain to me how the whole financing and the economics of gasoline.
Right.
Why, when the refinery is right out there, 2 miles away, are we paying more than they are in Seattle, where it's 100 miles away?
Right.
And they would try. And I believe they weren't talking BS to me. I think they were really trying to explain it. But what I got out of it is one complex, complicated kind of thing. And that suggests to me a couple of things. One, it may not all be something that the oil companies have control over. Two, it could be that it's so complicated they can get away with almost anything and explain it away, which it is. I do not know, but I think a little more regulation would be appropriate at this time. But. Because it's complex, we got to be sure we're regulating the right thing.
When we talk about regulating the right thing, Al, in your opinion, of course, what do you determine as being the right thing?
Well, how much money are they making at a time when the economy is down? Others are not making so much money. I think I read the other day that they are making a lot of money. And so if the price of gas is up, they're making a lot of money. Why can't they reduce the price of gas?
Well, that being the case, I know that today one of the reports we're hearing from the Hill is the issue with Congress trying to bring up the whole idea of possibly new regulations closing the loopholes on big oil.
Well, I shudder. When I said, be sure you're closing the right loopholes, that you're making the right regulation, Congress gets stampeded into doing that which will look good to their constituents, not always something that is effective.
Right.
And so you got to worry whether they're going to do the right thing.
Okay. Well, let's take a break real quick. We're going to talk to Blog Talk Radio offline. We're going to play some music for you in the break here. But this is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom in Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 2 minutes. This is Blog Talk Radio with a kind of skeleton crew working this show with Al Swift joining me here in the smoke-encrusted nerve center of Backroom Politics. We were talking a little bit before about the gasoline issue. It's we're trying to figure out exactly what the right approach is. Now, we were talking before, and you had mentioned about looking at all the profits that big oil is making right now. Exxon has come out and said that they've been making just stellar record profits. BP, Royal Dutch Shell, saying the same thing. Is there something that we as constituents of members of Congress can do that can say, hey, look, you know, we understand that, you know, we're in a free economy, but at some point, something's got to give. What exactly is that? Where's that breaking point, Al? Or is there one?
I don't know. And one of the things I think is a false thing to do is to tell people if you'll only raise a lot of hell, the members can make it go away. That is based on the assumption that the members know how to make it go away and they're just not doing it. The fact is, I'm not sure anyone knows for sure exactly what to do. But when you have them making those kinds of profits in an economy that is really tough on the middle class and poor people, you know, it's probably idealistic to suggest that a corporation should go gentle on people in tough times.
When we look at the tough times, quote unquote, when we look at exactly, you know, we've got the economic situation with the debt ceiling, we've got a deficit spending issue that's got to get under control. This has got to cause some of the members of Congress some little bit of heartburn, if you will, about their ability to go back to the districts. We just came back from the Easter break. We're starting to get a little bit of buzz about what kind of reception they got back in the districts. Do you think that that may have resonated enough with them to say, okay, we've got to get serious about this situation?
I think they knew when they went out on recess that they had to get serious about it. But I think when they went home and got yelled at, they also got frightened. And that's not a good situation in which to find rational solutions. The thing that has not happened, the Republicans have not done it. President Obama has not done it. They've not sat down with the American public and say, look, we're in a tough situation now. It is going to hurt. It's going to hurt everybody. We will do our dead level best to see that the pain is spread fairly.
Right.
Not just make it all tax the rich and so forth, because you need that economic engine to get things going. But likewise, you need to be able to put food on the table for your kids. And they have not done that. They have made a variety of proposals and even more accusations crossing the aisle. But nobody has really, no, it's not true. Most have not really laid out specifics. The Democrats have not. Congressman Ryan has, and his own party was among those that were shooting hard. But before you start telling people what you're going to cut and what pain there's going to be, you need to explain how you're going to handle the pain in a way that is fair. Otherwise, they will never accept it.
Well, let's see if we can bring Ralph Winnie up on the air. Ralph, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. I think one of the issues that needs to be addressed is oil exploration and development within the United States. We need to look for new sources of oil. We cannot rely on other countries for oil shipments. If you look at what the Chinese are doing, they're going all over the world trying to get oil and natural gas. They're also encouraging development within their own country of energy-related technologies. An area that's very fascinating and interesting is shale gas exploration and development, which is a major industry here in the U.S., and that is going to be very interesting to see if that is going to be able to help alleviate the gas situation in this country to bring down the prices. We also have to take into account the fact that the dollar is very, very weak. You cannot have a weak dollar and expect gas prices to remain stable and consistent.
Al, you had a comment.
I was just going to say that as much as it pains me, I think Ralph is correct. And one of the groups that's going to have to suffer some pain are going to be the environmentalists, who basically are in a position to tell everybody what we shouldn't do to create energy, but they never come up with a technology that will create energy that is practical at the time they suggest. I remember for wind power. Well, now they don't think that's so good now that you can, in fact, generate electricity with wind. So I think that they're going to have...
And I think it's important to recognize that all energy options have risks. There's never going to be a foolproof, safe option. Every energy option that you embark on is going to have some risks associated with it, but we absolutely need to focus on oil exploration, drilling, and development in this country if we want to continue to maintain our number one status and to keep the prices in check.
Well, you know, the one thing that we've also got to consider is, and this is what's shocking to me, is everybody's putting the onus on foreign oil again. And this is a topic that we've brought up many, many times on the air. It's still a matter of what we have is our biggest oil imports come from Canada and Mexico. We still have a tremendous amount of resources in the oil sands of Canada. We still have the oil shale here in the United States. On top of the fact we can still deal with the whole natural gas issue, which we apparently have an abundance of, but yet we still can't seem to get our arms wrapped around the energy crisis. Al, why are these facts going on deaf ears on the Hill, or are they?
Well, we really have never put together a decent energy policy. And I think Ralph is absolutely right that one of the things you've got to do with an energy policy is prioritize. Now, I wrote a little, it was a regional bill, the Northwest Regional Power Act, back in the late 80s, late 70s, as a matter of fact. And what we did in that legislation, because you remember whoops and the incredible problems with the nuclear plants out there, we said, this is the way you get energy that you need for running the Northwest. First of all the cost-effective, very important phrase, all the cost-effective conservation.
Right.
The second thing you go for is renewables. And all the way down to the very last thing was nuclear power. So you had, but all of it had to be cost-effective, and you could go down that list until you got to something that would work and was cost-effective. We don't have a sense of priorities in the country because we've never been able to agree on what they should be.
When, Ralph, we're going to come back to you. We had to put you on mute. Unfortunately, there was a lot of background noise on your end. But, Ralph, we're going to ask you a question. This is a story that Al's talking about, but it seems that the rest of the developed nations globally have taken its lead from their own sort of energy policies. They've invoked nuclear. They've invoked natural gas. Why are we not taking those similar lessons from what other countries have done worldwide?
Well, I think part of the reason, if you look at a country like China, they started with coal-fired power plants, and it was generating a lot of energy, a lot of electricity. But it was very dangerous, very unsafe, very harmful to its people. And as they were moving more and more people out of poverty into the middle class, these people were creating more and more energy to buy things like refrigerators, automobiles, electronics, and so forth and so on. So they began to look at what kind of alternative energy sources are available to meet the rising consumer demands of its population. The U.S. has not really been forced into that area. We've always had a constant middle class. We've always been able to have an abundant supply of oil and natural gas. But now, with the globalization of the world economy, things are starting to change. Everything is becoming much more competitive. And frankly, the U.S. has never really focused on inward development the way they should. It's about time that the U.S. focuses on exploitation of its own natural resources in a very safe, cost-effective manner in order to become competitive.
Al,
Justin's question was, why have these others seem to produce more energy and we haven't? The answer is they had to. I remember going to an international energy conference in Paris in about 1980, and it's amazing how those two oceans on either side of us isolate us from some of the thinking that goes on in the rest of the world. The fact was, sitting there with mostly these European countries and Japan, there were only a couple that were energy independent, England because of the, and Norway because of the North Sea Fine. we in this country have been talking for years about energy independence. None of those other nations could even conceivably imagine being energy independent.
But they seem to be far ahead of us in areas in key energy creation, i.e. nuclear.
Exactly, because they had to. We have
They put the money and the resources into developing new technologies. The U.S. has not made that a primary focus.
Right.
Because the fact is we haven't needed to.
Right, right.
Not with enough urgency.
Ralph, when we look at China and we look at, you know, they had coal deposits. They were able to generate a lot of, let's use electricity, for example, off of traditional coal-burning generation.
Sure.
When they started realizing that the environment was taking effect, it was causing health effects, which made the health ministry having to kick up in treating the citizens for health concerns, they started backing off. They started looking at additional, but that's when they started going globally for imports of your basic Brent-like crude.
Yes, and that's the point I was trying to make earlier. And they recognize that the West has these new technologies that would be very beneficial for the Chinese people. As China continues to enact policies whereby they're moving people out of the rural areas into the cities, improving their quality of life, as you move people up into the middle class, those people are going to create more energy because they demand more, especially on the consumer side. The growth of automobiles in China has been phenomenal, and that is creating a need for oil, gas, and other resources. And the Chinese recognize they have to exploit their own resources as well as to develop the technology that's available from partnering with Western countries in different projects.
And Ralph, we're getting a lot of wind noise coming from your end, but I got to ask the question is, what's the average price for gasoline going for in China right now?
That's a good question. I think it's about a quarter of what we're paying here.
Is the Chinese government regulating the price controls on that, or is the Chinese government subsidizing that in any way?
Yes, there is Chinese government regulation of the oil prices. That's one of the things that they do to keep the economy moving. They don't want speculation, and they want they are providing subsidies for people to buy automobiles and. They want to make sure that people will be able to buy gas, pay an affordable price.
Well, Al, is that something that the Congress is willing to take a stand on as far as regulating gas prices?
The Republicans will not stand for that unless we can resurrect Richard Nixon, who did toy with price controls at one time. It's just an anathema to them philosophically. So getting such through the House, I think, would be very difficult.
Is it an initiative that you think President Obama might stand up on?
He might, but I don't know his energy people well enough to know whether that would come out of the Department of Energy with big support or not.
Okay. Well, we're coming up in the bottom of the hour. We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about some of the economic issues that are floating around Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics. I've got Al Swift here at Shelley's. We've got Ralph Winnie on the line from Hawaii. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Backroom. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us. Thank you.
da da, wa da da da, da 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 da, da da da, wa da 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 da.
We're back live from Shelley's back room in Washington, D.C. Backroom Politics live on the air at full strength again. With me, as always, is Congressman Al Swift. We've got Ralph Winnie on the line joining us. We were talking about earlier the economy.
You're Justin Russell.
I am Justin Russell. I am your moderator. I fail to mention that every time. I kind of think it's everybody recognizes my voice. We were talking a little bit earlier about the economy and the effect of the gas prices, and how the gas prices are now hitting $4 a gallon as a nationwide average. When we talk about that and everybody trying to take austerity measures in cutting costs, you know, cut their spending, this has got to have an impact on the overall political scene on the Hill. This has got to be something that's got to be on everybody's mind, Al. When we look at that, what are some of the thoughts? You had a great observation I'd love you to bring up as while we were on break.
Well, one of the things that came up in that energy conference in Paris in 1980 was that even if all of the developed countries were able to meet all of their energy needs easily, we still, if we're going to allow developing countries to develop, they're going to need more energy too. Which led in that particular conference most of the Europeans to say that the developed countries needed to use nuclear so that they could use the less technically complex forms of energy in the developing countries. Now, that's just a case of when you're at the pump paying $4 plus, it's a little hard to think about what's going on in Mexico or other developing countries. But the fact is, ultimately, you're going to need enough energy for everybody, and that explains how big the problem is, how widespread.
Ralph, when we talk about, you know, I mean, Al's talking about an energy conference from back in 1980.
Yeah.
It's been a topic that we've been dealing with, toying with for so long, and yet we continue to tread water or tap dance around this issue. Are you seeing anything in your travels that would parlay into solid American policy here?
I think one of the areas that's interesting is the nuclear. Generally, that is very cost efficient, provides obviously the requisite amount of energy that a country would need. And generally, if it's not managed in a very safe and efficient manner, there aren't the problems. Everyone now has been pointing to what's happened in Japan. But what's interesting about that situation is it wasn't the earthquake. In fact, when the earthquake happened, the reactors automatically shut down. What really caused the damage was the tsunami. So it was a true act of God, really, that caused the nuclear meltdown there. But countries like China have no qualms using nuclear power, building nuclear power stations. They feel that that is one of the ways that they can generate the amount of energy that they need for their people. In the U.S., obviously, nuclear is very, very problematic because of Three Mile Islands, and certainly the focus is currently is on what's happened in Japan.
When Al, as we look at this whole package, when we look at the $4 again, when we look at the calls for austerity measures, we look at tax cuts, tax breaks, all the loopholes. We touched on it a little bit earlier, but there's a fine line between regulating and just cutting out some, or having big oil pay their fair share. How do we balance that fine line, or can we?
Well, First of all, you got 535 members of Congress, which means you probably got about 600 ways to do that. and not all of them work. One of the things, we wasted an enormous amount of time and money coming up with kind of crazy ideas. Making gasoline out of corn, where it costs you more to do that than it does to buy the oil. I mean, it's a crazy idea. Very popular in the corn-growing Midwest.
I was going to say, there are certain farmers in Iowa that would greatly disagree with you.
Absolutely. But I think...
And ethanol has been very effective in Brazil, in their automobile industry and empowering their energy needs. But it would be too cost prohibitive for the U.S. to embark on any kind of ethanol campaign.
And what was the thing that Jim Wright was doing? God, he had a pet project that they finally killed off, but it wasn't oil shale. It was something like that,
that may be similar to the Boone Pickens plan. Where it's a combination of wind energy, combination of some sort of ethanol, and
natural gas,
yes.
Right.
Well, it's
and that's
not being
to
any,
see if that plan is implemented in the near future by the Obama administration.
Any great fan of Boone Pickens, I think we're at a point where we need to not discard any suggestion. In fact, one of the things that I think that the leadership, whether it came from the president or whether it comes from the leaders in the Congress, is anybody who's against some form of energy that's proposed should have to answer the question, how would you provide it? I think we've let, for example, the environmentalists off the hook too long without ever saying, how would you provide it? And so the people that don't like coal, how would you provide it? People who don't like nuclear, how would you provide it? So that we can force the argument back into practical realities of what might work.
Well, now that we're back at full strength, we'd like to invite everybody out there listening to call in. Our dial-in number is 619-638-8477. Again, that number is 619-638-8477. If you'd like to offer your thoughts on the current gas prices and how it's affecting the economy or anything that might pique your interest inside, outside the Beltway, we're willing to bring it in front of the round table. Ralph, finally on this topic, when we look at everything that's going on, we have to beg the issue of the role of OPEC in all of this, that somehow OPEC is either going to look at this. Nobody's come out and said that they're going to increase production in the Arab Peninsula. OPEC has been oddly silent throughout this whole ordeal. Is that by design, or are they just going to monitor this until it gets to a point blank and everybody just starts crying wolf or crying uncle, and then they're going to have to make something happen? How's OPEC going to play out?
Well, OPEC is watching very closely what happens with the vote on raising our debt ceiling. They're looking at that very, very closely because the IMF has actually come out and said that the age of America has come to an end by 2016 because the growth of the Chinese economy is going to surpass the U.S. economy, and the size of America's debt and deficit has grown to the point of public alarm in the international community. So what this means is obviously the debt ceiling has to be raised, but when that happens, we're just going to go further and further in debt without draconian cuts across the board. And I don't know if the U.S. is in a position to do that. If we raise the debt ceiling, are we going to have these corresponding draconian cuts that are going to be needed to bring our economy in order? And until that's done, you're not going to have gas prices come back down to any reasonable level. The other issue, of course, is looking at oil exploration, as I said, and development in the U.S. The tragic issue is that we can do it. We have shale gas opportunities here in the U.S. The Chinese, obviously, are very interested. They're trying to take interest in some of these shale gas development projects. There's a couple in Texas that they're eyeing, as well as in Canada. So the U.S. has the technology, they have the know-how and the understanding to be able to effectively develop the shale gas. But do we have the political will? That's really going to be the question. And part of that is going to have to be making the environmentalists understand that we, for the survival of our country, we have got to focus on developing resources within our country in a very safe and efficient, cost-efficient manner.
And how we get there is the difficult question. It seems to me, for example, that you could make the argument that the only people with any guts on Capitol Hill are the Tea Party people, and they haven't got, and they're not sane. You know, I mean, they will come out strongly for something, but it won't work. Where are the people that are the thoughtful people? They're all hiding behind a bush somewhere, because the truth is the answer is going to be unpopular.
Right. You know, it's no different than what we're seeing with the total economic situation. We're having to make decisions that are going to be unpopular across the board. It's just that this is something that we've talked about numerous times on this show. There's still not that single individual leader that's willing to stand up and take that bullet.
There's only one, I think, in a position to do it effectively, and that's the president, any president. I'm not just pointing at Obama, but that's the leader of the country.
Go ahead, Ralph.
I can tell you this. What most people don't realize is that Singapore now has become the trading hub for the RMB. That's the Chinese yuan.
Right.
The Chinese are trying to diversify away from the dollar. This is really worrying Washington, D.C., people in the Obama administration. And that's why they're having the strategic economic dialogue this week to try and iron out a lot of these issues, because the U.S. is very worried that once the Chinese divest themselves away from the dollar, the negative impact it's going to have on our economy.
But I keep coming back to the point that you've got to prepare the public for the fact that we've got hard times. We fought two wars without ever paying for it.
Right.
But it's all on borrowed money. We have not had a draft. You know, we haven't asked for any personal sacrifice from the American public at all to fight two wars. And we haven't really laid the groundwork for what we're going to need to do to work toward our deficit. And this is just another thing where it's mostly bad news, and we have not prepared the ground for it.
Well, I'll tell you what. This is going to be a subject that's going to be coming back over the next few weeks. It's not a subject that's going to go away. And it's something that we're going to have a lot of dialogue about. I know in the next few weeks we're going to try and get a couple of economists on the air to kind of give us their perspective on the near-term and long-term future of some of the decisions that have to be made. It's a quarter to the hour right now here it's quarter to the hour everywhere in the world right now. We're going to take a quick break. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Back Room. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us.
Not for
There's a lot of truth to that. I hope we're not bothering you.
Living on love and pale moonlight. Just you and I. Forever and a day. Love will not die.
Here on Backroom Politics here in Washington, D.C. It is now 10 minutes to the hour, top of the hour. We're going to be talking a little bit now about the aftermath of the Osama bin Laden operation. We wanted to get Ralph Winnie connected before we started into that. That's obviously something that's been dominating a lot of the discussions here in Washington, D.C. The number of stories that we're hearing about the intelligence that was gathered, the number of stories that we're seeing about the operation itself, the success of the operation, some of the concerns, the political fallout is just running rampant through Washington, D.C., as it is through the international communities. But it is still something that's got everybody's attention still to this moment. When last week when we were talking to our guests about the Obama operation, one of the questions we asked them is, now what? And we got some really good insight as to what's next. We're looking at a fractionalized or a sectionalized version of Al-Qaeda now being a threat, whether it's out of Yemen, whether it's the Tamil Tigers out of the Philippines, whether it's independent lone wolf Islamic extremists that might be out there somewhere, similar to the Times Square bombing attempt. There's a lot of concerns that are now flying around the situation with the bin Laden operation as it ties into global security. But the big item that's been coming out in the past couple of days, or the past week rather, has been the issue with Pakistan and what did Pakistan know. There's conflicting information about what they knew, what they gave us, how involved they were in the operation itself. Did they even know the operation was going to go down? The consensus of the information being drawn out is that the fact the Pakistani government did not know that that operation was going to happen, that the Pakistani government played a very, very minor role, if any, into the overall intelligence gathering on this particular site. But it does beg the question, and Al, being a former member of Congress, you've been seated in several security briefings. With all that we're starting to find out about Osama bin Laden's existence in Abbottabad, when we see how close he was to the Pakistani military academy, how close he was to several ISI operations, ISI being the intelligence service of Pakistan, does it strike you as that there might have been some complacency inside Pakistan of bin Laden's existence in Abbottabad?
complacency or or I don't trust Pakistan in part because I don't think there's one voice that's speaking for all of the various ideas and policies that Pakistan has. It could very well be that the military has a somewhat different view than the government and so forth and so on. I wanted to mention one thing before we forget it. With all the talk that is going on, there has been very, very little criticism. There's been analysis and analysis and analysis of the operation, but very little of it has been at all negative. It's things like what was Pakistan's role and so forth, and I think that's is significant as we move forward.
Right. Do you think with the lack of armchair quarterbacking going on, there's got to be lessons learned? We know that DOD is going to do what they would call a postmortem or an after-op debriefing. When that goes through, there's still a lot of unanswered questions, which is ultimately going to be key in some of the decisions we make going forward in international affairs. You're looking at possibly $3 billion worth of military aid going to the Pakistani government, which is now very much in jeopardy. That's probably something you would not vote for if you were seated in Congress right now. Is that accurate?
I would be. I'd want a hell of a lot more information than I currently have before I would support that kind of money going to Pakistan.
Well, when we look at this, Ralph, from a global perspective, what have you been hearing from the international community as far as the aftermath politically on the Obama administration and its operation on bin Laden?
Well, I think Obama has always been perceived as very weak on international security and defense. And there were these issues as to whether he was really committed in going after Osama bin Laden. I think Obama has answered all of his critics and has made a very successful argument that he is the commander-in-chief. He can act very decisively. He's not a wishy-washy. He's not a Jimmy Carter. One of the interesting things to point out is this issue of whether the enhanced interrogation techniques generated evidence that led to the U.S. being able to find Obama's whereabouts. In other countries, those kind of interrogation techniques are sort of par for the course. You don't have the same sort of debate and discussion that we have had in this country as to whether those interrogation techniques constitute torture or whether they're legitimate means of getting suspects to talk. So I think at the end of the day, the operation was very, very successful. I think it shows that when the U.S. says they're going to do something, they follow through and act decisively. And I think, personally, for Obama, it shows that he is a very decisive leader.
Well, Al, the Bush administration took a lot of heat for the use of enhanced interrogation techniques, whether it was in the field at foreign locations, whether it was enhanced interrogation techniques used at Guantanamo Bay. Yet, as Ralph pointed out, the stuff we were doing is considered tame. They do some of these enhanced interrogation techniques on people committing misdemeanors in many instances. Is there a double standard here in the United States than there is globally regarding enhanced interrogation techniques, do you think?
Not according to George Bush.
Really?
Well, I mean, he did it. Now, here's what I don't know. I think the real argument here is using those, does that give you more information or does it give you misinformation? We know that in at least one instance, and I can't remember the name of the fellow, but a higher up Al-Qaeda official who was in fact tortured or used enhanced
interrogation techniques. Remember, we do not torture, Al.
That's right. And what he told him was wrong. He lied to him. He gave him information, but it was wrong. And so you need a panel of psychologists, I suppose, to argue this out. But How do you know that if you use these enhanced techniques, you in fact are getting more information than you would by using other techniques that are subtler, that seem, in reports I've seen, seem to give you better information?
Well, Ralph, I pose a question to you. With the double standard, it seems, that we're being held to globally here in the United States for the use of enhanced interrogation techniques, why is it that we've seen such an uproar from the global community about that when, in fact, a lot of these countries do use these techniques in-house?
Because we admitted it.
Yeah, we're very forthright about the policies that we're engaged in. I think other countries, there's a perception that America bullies the rest of the world, and this is just an opportunity for some countries to kind of say that America doesn't practice what they preach. But I think overall, if you talk to people, everyone is very pleased that Bin Laden was killed, because it has created a great divide within Al-Qaeda. They don't have a leader. They're still kind of scrambling to determine what to do. And I think this is a very successful outcome. Now we've got to kind of win the hearts and the minds of the people in the Middle East.
And part of that is
going to be working to deal with the Israeli-Palestinian issue.
Right.
That's kind of the root of a lot of
it. I'm kind of coming from the standpoint of I'm shocked that these other countries are hypocritical.
That's just par for the course. I don't put any stock in it. I think the U.S. has always been forthright about what our goals and our aspirations are, and we are a very noble country, and it makes other people jealous, I think, in a lot of ways.
Right. Al, when we look at, you know, how much information now is coming out, there's been a tremendous amount of intel that they have decided to declassify as a result of this operation. Does that surprise you a little bit?
It would have under other administrations, both Democrats and Republicans. This administration seems to be a little more open tend to stamp top secret on fewer things than previous administrations. So in that sense, I'm a little surprised, yes.
Are they going a little bit too far, in your opinion? Is there stuff that's coming out right now that, as a member of Congress, you would have looked and said, wait a minute, hold on, I'm not necessarily sure that the public needs to necessarily see this?
That is a question that will be answered in the future. I mean, it really depends on what is the result of releasing this information. The safest way to play it is not release it, but
you have to release some info so that that Al-Qaeda cannot use it as a PR tool to say that Osama bin Laden is still alive. That's where I think releasing the pictures showing that he was killed would be very effective at quashing any kind of effort by Al-Qaeda to make the point that Osama bin Laden is still alive.
And I would suspect that guys like Leon Panetta,
right,
and the Secretary of Defense Gates, and the Secretary of State and the President are not going to be revealing so much information that you are given great insight into our spy operations, into our intelligence operations. It may be more information about this particular thing, but I'll bet you it doesn't go to the core of our international strategies in this area.
Does this beg the question right now, Al, that with the success that the intelligence community's had with the apprehension and the Bin Laden operation, does this now bode well for future funding, increased funding for our intel community, something that's been called into question by several members of Congress?
I would think so. Success breeds success, and I think success in the field breeds success in the Appropriations Committee. Now, the situation is that we've got to make huge cuts. So how those two balance out, I don't know. But I would think under normal circumstances, which we are not in, this would increase the appropriation.
Well, as we're talking right now here in the smoke-encrusted nerve center of backroom politics, on the big screen we're seeing CNN is reporting that DHS and DOD and Department of State are issuing a bulletin saying that there is the potential for lone wolf attacks, which means that, similar to what we heard last week from our guests from the Naval Postgraduate School and the Homeland Security Institute, what we heard was that this is not over by any means. We can't let our guard down. Does this also breed success into appropriations for a department like DHS?
I would think so, yes.
Does it bode well for, you just talked about the intelligence community,
yeah.
Does this bode well, or how does this impact Secretary Gates' austerity measures over at DOD?
Well, it seemed to me that DOD and CIA are two different things. They obviously work closely together and so forth and so on. But what we need now is a better financed spy system or intelligence operation. I don't know that we need more planes, more tanks, more of that kind of stuff. So I would think that the cuts that have been proposed by Gates could stand and still put some of those savings into all of the intelligence agencies.
But when we look at the total intelligence community, there's been talk that it's too segmented. There's a lot of infighting. There has been a lot of infighting in the intel community. Do you think the Obama administration will now put down the edict saying, look, you all have to play nice? We're riding a wave of success. Now's the time we come together as one.
One of the things that seems to have been a consensus growing out of this affair was that the various intelligence agencies were in fact told that, and in fact did function that way. They exchanged information, they worked together, and they had an enormous success. So it puts the president in a good position, it seems to me, to say, fellas, you did it right that time, let's continue to do it right, and stomp on people that are going out playing the Lone Ranger.
Ralph, going back to you, when the international community starts seeing some of the information that's pouring out of Washington regarding the operation, does this scare the international community that the United States might take similar actions inside their borders?
I think because we acted very, very decisively. Obama has authorized the use of those drone fighters for several years now to seek out targets and to kill people that have been involved in terrorist activity in the United States. And there are issues on whether that's constitutional or not in this country. So certainly other countries are looking at what the actions of the U.S., the fact that we've successfully killed Osama bin Laden, and will continue to use those drone fighters to go after people that have engaged or attempted to engage in hostile actions towards the U.S. I think it sends a very, very strong message that the U.S. is not a weak country. And I think, of course, this looks very, very good for Obama.
Go ahead, Al.
But it seems to me that any country that is not doing what Pakistan was doing, that is not harboring intentionally or unintentionally a major threat to the United States, countries that aren't doing that, I think, should not have any worry about us, going in across their borders.
Well, let's look at that aspect when we come back from the break. We're going to talk about that aspect along with the idea of, can we in fact trust the Pakistani government, and how much of a threat now is Pakistan? Is that the new center? Is that the new focus of where our intention should be? This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Back Room on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us. Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital. It's now 10 minutes past the top of the hour. Actually, again, everywhere. It is myself, your moderator, Justin Russell. It is the former 8-term member of Congress from Washington 2nd District, Congressman Al Swift, here in Shelley's with me. On the line is Dr. Ralph Winnie, the Vice President of the Eurasia Center and our international affairs expert. As we were coming into the break, we were talking a little bit about the effects of the Osama bin Laden operation politically as we've been perceived globally and the aftermath of that. But what we want to talk about right now is more specifically the Pakistani question. The question now comes up about Pakistan is, one, can we trust them? And Al, I pose that question to you is, can we in fact, again, the question that I asked in the last segment, but I want to dive a little bit deeper, is can we, in fact, trust Pakistan?
I think that the answer is no, but we have to. We have to within some range because they are so strategic to a number of things that we're interested in. I think it's a very awkward position for us to be in.
I got to tell you, I'm going to take off my moderator's hat for a second and put on my pundit hat for a second. You know, the issue with Pakistan is a little bit disturbing to me. When we look at, we cannot fight the front in Afghanistan without being able to get the supplies and be able to root through Pakistan. We cannot have an effective presence in that region without some sort of reliance on the Pakistani government, which is troubling. When we look at that, and we look at the, I'm going to use the word complacency, that was demonstrated.
Not complicity.
I'm going to say complacency in the actions of not just the Pakistani government, but more specifically their intelligence agency, the ISI, it does beg the question that we, in fact, have put too much of a reliance on the relationship that we have with Pakistan without actually backing it up with, can we trust them? Now,
Justin, I think the key here is you trust, but you verify.
No, I agree with you on that one, Ralph. I absolutely believe that we have to trust but verify. But, you know, with a possible $3 billion in defense aid going to Pakistan as a result of whether it's rent or whatever you want to call it, their involvement in our Afghan front,
what you have to have is you have to have effective advisors advising the government, the elements in the government that are very pro-Western. Obviously, you have a lot of pro-Islamic fundamentalist elements there, and it's sort of a tightrope that you have to really balance. It's very similar to what's happened in Lebanon, where you had a Western-oriented government, but many factions were very pro-Islamic fundamentalist. And if you look at what China has been able to do, they have advisors, they have strong business contacts with Pakistan. Because originally, when many of their people in their Muslim community wanted to study in Pakistan and work over there, they ended up going into these madras schools and then coming back and becoming very radicalized. So the Chinese recognized how important it was to have their presence there in the form of advisors and strong support in the business community. And the U.S. has to do the same thing. You're balancing very strong interests on both sides, but the U.S. can do it.
Well, you know, the concern that we have now is the fact that, you know, we have to have somewhat of a verifiable trust with Pakistan, the fact that they are a nuclear power. But it's a concern when you see the Muslim extremist movement in Pakistan that close to the big red button. Now, we have situations, and I guess I pose this question to you, Ralph, is with our operation into what many have called Afghan sovereignty or Pakistani sovereignty by going in and conducting a military extradition on Pakistani soil, is this going to make the Pakistani government kind of bow up a little bit and maybe show their muscle against somebody like India?
I think the Pakistanis they want to show that they are a strong and united and powerful country. Our operation there made them look very weak and inefficient, especially since we did not feel comfortable sharing with them the details of the operation itself. Certainly, the Pakistani government is very critical of any suggestion that they are not united against the war on terrorism. But the reality of the situation is there are strong Islamic fundamentalists with ties to some elements in the Pakistani government, which makes it incumbent on the U.S. to have a very strong team of advisors in both the business and the political arena in Pakistan to ensure that U.S. interests are protected. As I said before, other countries are doing the same thing. China had to do it because so many of their Muslims became very radicalized and started committing terrorist actions in China. So it's incumbent for the U.S. to recognize how important it is to have a strong advisory presence there. Yeah. And in some cases, it may mean that the U.S. is not going to share everything that they have on intelligence operations with the Pakistani government, because frankly they don't know who they can really trust.
Well, one of the questions now is, are there certain controls that we can put in place? Is there some sort of incentives we can give to the Pakistani government that in fact you've got to keep tight control on your nuclear arsenal? Is there something that Congress can suggest that the State Department might implement that, or we reach it?
Let me answer that with a question. Given what we did with Osama bin Laden, shouldn't they have gotten that message already? that you can stretch us just so far, and then we're going to do what is in our best interests. That's a lesson they should have learned in this process.
Well, I would hope so, but here's the question it begs to go question to question to question is, if you're the Pakistani government, or if you're any foreign government for that matter, where does this end? Do we do the same thing in Yemen? Now, we've had military operations in Yemen in conjunction with the Yemeni government, but it's got to beg the question to the Yemeni government that, hey, they may do the same thing here, which, hey, I don't want them invading. It would be no different than Canada conducting a military operation inside our borders. So the question...
The bottom line is might makes right, and this operation is going to send a signal to other countries like Yemen that they better get a grip on their Islamic fundamentalist element. Otherwise, the U.S. is going to take decisive action.
But now the question becomes is, how far can we keep at bay the Pakistani government in relation to the operation and in relation to our relationship as a whole with Islamabad? Can we, in fact, make good on this relationship at some point? And what would it take, Al, to convince you that they truly are an ally in the region?
I think that, excuse me, it seems to me that if what we have done already hasn't sent the message, then we are no worse off than we were before. It just seems to me that we've got to be better off in terms of our relationships with Pakistan. Not that they're going to roll over and do everything we told them. Not that they haven't got their own Muslims, extremists that they have to deal with. But I think they're going to be a little less coy about it, given what we did.
Ralph, do you think that the reaction out of Islamabad would have been different under an administration with Benazir Bhutto or somebody of that sect in politics?
She was, because she had been educated in the U.S., she was a lot more sympathetic to the U.S. point of view and had certainly a closer relationship with people in government. But I think at the end of the day, she would have still been very concerned because she had... would have had to have dealt with radical Islamic fundamentalist elements within her country. And how does she balance that with her desire to help America in their war against terrorism? See, the whole issue is this radical Islamic fundamentalist movement has tentacles in all of these Arab countries. And the old guard Arab leadership is having to finally come to grips with this. And unfortunately, this Islamic fundamentalist element has, in some instances, won over the hearts and the minds of the people because a lot of these regimes have, for the many years, been extremely corrupt. And Benazir Bhutto, that was one of the issues that her regime was very, very corrupt. And it led to her having to step down. And then eventually, when she did come back into office, she angered the Islamic fundamentalist wing and was assassinated.
I think it's very interesting to me that there may be a strange parallel between the situation that we're talking about and the Republicans in the House of Representatives.
Really?
John Boehner is generally a rather widely respected conservative. Respected in and out of the institution, but he's got the Tea Party people that he has to deal with. He's got to deal with their demands, with their threats,
right?
As Pakistan's leadership have to deal with the radical Muslims. So maybe we should go ask John Boehner how he's doing it up there and apply the same technique.
Politics is a major issue anywhere in the world, but. If you're able to balance that with the legitimate need of moving your country forward, then you're a real superstar in this whole equation.
When we look back at the relationship that we've had with Islamabad and we look at going forward, what what do you vision in your knowledge of the relationship, Alan, and understanding the fact that you were never on the Intelligence Committee, you were never served on the Foreign Services Committee, it was still a member of Congress, you were privy to a lot of this. What would you see as being a proactive role that we could take in making Pakistan a more stable ally in the region?
Well, you thankfully gave me an out. I mean, I don't know a lot of the detail that
right.
you need to answer that question. It seems to me there are people up there, sensible people in both parties on the Foreign Relations Committee and Armed Services Committee and what have you, that could answer that question, but I don't know what it is. I wish we had Richard Lugar here.
That would be nice.
Or the Vice President.
Ralph, final question before we take a break. When all is said and done, what do you feel might be a good way forward in improving the relationship and making them a trusted ally, or is there anything that we can do? We just have to deal with them as a stepchild.
Well, we have to have an effective group of advisors that builds a very close working relationship between both countries. We also have to focus on winning over the hearts and the minds of the Pakistani people, which unfortunately we have not done a very successful job at. The Islamic fundamentalist element has been very successful in that area, especially the people in the rural areas, the poor villagers, so forth and so on. So the key is for the U.S. to have a very strong presence in Pakistan, to be active and visible in the rural areas so that people learn to trust America and realize what a noble country that we are. That will serve to include any effect the Islamic fundamentalist element has in the Pakistani community and in the Pakistani government.
Does organizations like USAID, the Agency for International Development, and USTDA, do they have a role in this? Is that something we need to lean on more effectively than we do on the military front?
Those organizations play a very positive and pivotal role in developing this close personal relationship with the Pakistani people. That's essential for that to improve and create positive relations between Pakistan and the U.S.
Ralph, I missed the very beginning of that sentence. Who is it that needed to do that?
Justin was listing three organizations.
USAID.
USAID.
What were the other two again?
It was USAID and TDA.
Yes, and as I said, all of those organizations play a very positive and crucial role in connecting with Pakistani people, especially in the rural areas, in an effort to promote positive relations between the U.S. and Pakistan moving forward.
This way
you're able to dilute any type of influence that the Islamic fundamentalists have in those communities and also in the Pakistani government.
Thank you. That clarifies.
Okay. We're going to take a break here. We'll be back in 2 minutes. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, live on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us.
Thank you.
And welcome. We're back here at Chili's Back Room here in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio. We're going to kind of take a different track right now, and we want to touch on the developing story coming out of El Paso, Texas. At about 3:30 Eastern time, the president gave a speech regarding immigration and immigration reform. The president was very critical of the GOP and how they've been dealing with the immigration question. His quote is, they'll never be satisfied. He also went on to say that the Republicans have been pushing a lot of laws, but no such reform. When we look at that question, Al, what is the president looking for? What exactly is his benchmark that we need to get to that will make him satisfied that the GOP is, in fact, playing on the same sheet of music?
I think the thing that troubles him most is that they want to get rid of all the illegals before they do anything, and that is probably impossible. And therefore, it prevents us from moving forward in something that will work.
And now, with this comment of there's been a lot of laws and no such reform, is he stretching a little bit on that one? I mean, with laws, I mean, the GOP is going to say, look, our laws are reform. We're reforming the current benchmark that we had prior to us being seated as Congress, and we've moved forward, whether it's the Secure Border Initiative, which was arguably successful or unsuccessful, depending on who you talk to. You look at some of the new initiatives coming out of ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Bureau, where they're deputizing now a lot of the local law enforcement agencies to enforce some of the immigration rules. Is there something that we're missing in immigration reform that we haven't touched on yet, Al, do you know of?
I think that, yes. I think there's a lot of, what's the word? We've got ourselves all hung up on what is very close to being a prejudicial kind of view about Latin America and Mexicans. And it's a very emotional argument that they are here illegally. Well, yeah, they're here illegally. By definition, that doesn't mean that they're criminals. So that there are ways of dealing with the illegals that are here and illegals that are coming that do not require the draconian kind of actions that many Republicans demand.
When we look at the question on immigration, we look internationally at some of the situations that are out there, particularly in Europe. We look at the tension between Italy and France and the immigration question there. There's been talk about coming up with a unified EU immigration policy, which has sparked a lot of debate. What are we doing differently than what they might be doing overseas, for example?
Well, most countries have very strict immigration laws. It's very difficult to become a citizen in Europe. Just being born in say France or Switzerland does not automatically make you a citizen. You have to wait at least 10 years and then apply to become a citizen. You know, a lot of countries ask that you have a certain monetary requirement as well to be a citizen. They have no compulsion about sending people back if they're not properly registered to be in the respective country. So the U.S. is very liberal in terms of the amount of people that we allow in. The countries in Europe are very concerned about the racial dynamics of their country. They want to preserve their heritage, and they're very concerned about allowing large groups of people that don't speak the language and want to maintain their old customs and traditions. So the U.S. Has been very welcoming of people from many different backgrounds and ethnic nationalities. What's making the situation so problematic is the issues with security. We've got these drug cartels in Mexico that are basically holding that whole country hostage, indiscriminately killing people. Does not matter what your ethnic or racial or immigration status is. If you're in the way, you will be taken out. And we have got to secure our border because we do not want these drug cartels coming into this country and wrecking havoc. The other issue is you have people that are being enslaved by these cartels that are trafficking men, women, and children across the border at will and forcing them to work and treating them horribly in sweatshops, brothels, so forth and so on. And then, unfortunately, there are a lot of people on both sides of the border that are on the pay because of the amount of money that's involved. So you've got to break up these cartels. You've got to have a consistent immigration policy, and you have to make the case to the American people that our security is very, very important. We don't want a dirty bomb being able to get across the border and being set off in New York or D.C. There's no question that if Iran is able to develop the technology, they're going to either sell it or give it away to a radical Islamic fundamentalist group that will use the Mexican border to get this across into a major metropolitan city in the U.S.
But going back to the president's comments regarding the GOP on immigration reform, it seems to me, or at least the perception has been, that the GOP has been on the front line of making some needed changes in immigration policy to move forward and keep balancing the act of still being the country of liberty versus opening us to possible terrorism attacks. Obama seems to think that, you know, we're not moving forward. We're just throwing stuff against the wall and see it stick. Al, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. First of all, I don't think that our effort to stop illegal immigration at the border has worked. I remember a cartoon showed a fence along the border, and it said this is a 14-foot high fence, and next to it was a sign that said this is the future home of Jose's 15-foot ladders. And so I think that we either are going to have to figure out an effective way of preventing illegals, or we're going to have to recognize what maybe the reality is, that we can't do that, then what do we do? And what is the problem that the illegals are posing locally here in this country, and how can we minimize the negative impact that may have on us? And in that area, I haven't heard any ideas from the Republicans at all.
Well, it's important for the GOP because they recognize that they cannot alienate the Hispanic community through draconian immigration policy. If they do that, then the Hispanics go the way of the blacks, the Republicans will be the minority party for the next generation. Because the growing trend in this country is among the Latinos, among the minorities, who tend to vote for the Democratic Party. And tend to vote for the Democratic Party, and the Republicans have got to find a way to be able to connect with these growing minority groups, and otherwise, they will be truly a minority. Republicans will become a minority party.
Well, that being said, Al, and everything, all things considered, in this argument, when we look at true immigration reform, what possibly are the Democrats going to bring up, or what could we possibly do that doesn't involve securing the borders itself, investing in new technology, investing in ground forces on the border? What can we possibly do?
Well, I'm just off the top of my head, it would seem to me that if we find illegals, and we can find illegals, rather than deporting, say, okay, what you have to do is, one, you got to learn English, and provide the means by which they can do that. And secondly, you have to apply for citizenship and provide the means for that. In short, if once we find them, we ought to be able to continue to keep track of them and enforce that kind of thing. That would do two things. It would tell people in Mexico, it seems to me, that when you get over there, you are going to have to do some things that you are do not now have to do, and that may change the equation for them as to whether they want to come here.
Well, when we look at the immigration issue, I mean, the reality is that unfortunately we have an economy that has built in reliance on some of that labor force. A lot of Americans who have grown up feeling entitled in the past few decades won't do house cleaning in hotels. They won't do manual labor in the agricultural community. They won't do some of those jobs.
Nor will the children of those illegals.
Really?
The illegals are they don't speak English. Their children will.
Right.
They get a better standard of living than they get at home often. Their children are not going to be happy with that. They're going to want to be more like their contemporaries in America.
Well, then the children are entitled to a free public education, according to the Supreme Court under the standard of intermediate scrutiny, which holds that there's no fundamental rights in education. But
well,
we cannot punish the children for the sins of their parents.
Why would we want them to remain ignorant and untrained? I mean, money spent on educating them is better than money spent on dealing with the poverty that they will otherwise have.
And it does beg the question, though, that, you know, if they are going to remain here, do we want, because obviously under the current U.S. law, those that are born, even of illegal immigrants, those born here are in fact entitled for U.S. citizenship. Do we not see, where do we close that gap, I guess, is the question.
Well, the United States has a very bad past history of how it deals with immigrants. Bob Hines, who is not here today, can remember when his grandfather found Irene to apply.
Right.
And we have... We treated the Asians, in particular the Chinese that came here, very, very badly. We know what we did with the Japanese during the Second World War. Southern Europeans had problems when they first came. Eastern Europeans had problems when they first came. The Statue of Liberty and give us your tired, your poor is all wonderful. The problem is that people do.
Right.
And then when they get here, we hear these same arguments. They're going to take away our jobs. They're going to do this, they're going to do that. Part of the problem with illegal immigration now is that we've got this wonderful phrase, illegal immigration. The fact is, we have not welcomed new foreign people in this country easily since the Indians resisted us.
But we are a melting pot of different cultures. That's what makes our country so special and so noble. If you look at what's happened in Europe, you look at Switzerland, many people don't realize, but if you remember when the Jews were trying to escape from Germany, they would go into Switzerland, and the Swiss, if they caught them, they would send them right back over the border into Germany. Swiss were the ones that were responsible for the day being stamped and any passports owned by a Jewish person. You look at what's happened in China when you had many North Koreans that were escaping across the border into China, many of them simply looking for food. There was a strong Korean community within China, as well as some elements of the Han community that would help these Korean refugees. But if the Chinese police caught any of these Korean refugees, they were automatically sent back over the border because they were there in China illegally. So you know, and you know, the Chinese would say, we have our own people to feed and take care of. We cannot absorb all these other refugees.
Every nation will. When I said that we had a poor record on this, I didn't mean to say that we were unique in any regard or bad people. The fact is that the human beings get into an us versus them situation with anybody that is new. And it's a human reaction, and you're pointing out how it's going on in other countries. But the fact is that that doesn't mean that we have to base national policy on that prejudice.
Well, we're going to take a quick break here on Backroom Politics. When we come back, we're going to go into Freeform, and we're going to go into our Tell Me a Story segment. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Back Room on Blog Talk Radio, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital. It is America's premier cigar lounge, and we're live. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us. We're back here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio. With me, as always, is Congressman Al Swift, Dr. Ralph Winnie on the line from Hawaii, and I'm your moderator, Justin Russell. And Tell Me a Story starts now. Al, tell me a story.
Haley Barbour pulled out of the Republican race. And there'd been a lot of talk about why he did that.
Right.
I had a theory, and by God, I saw it. Somebody else agreed with in the newspaper recently. I think Haley Barbour pulled out because he doesn't think a Republican, any Republican, is going to win the next presidential election.
Really? Coming from the former chairman of the RNC, he thinks it's a losing effort.
That's my theory.
Interesting thought. Very interesting thought.
Because he would have been a powerful...
A very powerful candidate.
He's got some strong negatives he'd have to deal with, but he's very, very good.
Interesting. Ralph, tell me a story.
The Obama is going down to Texas in the next day or so.
Well, he's there now.
He's there now. Look for a major press
policy statements that come out of this.
Okay, interesting. I think we may have seen it at 3:30, but we'll get up to date on that here after the show. All right, Al, here it is.
Yeah.
You ready for this?
I'm. You've been threatening this since I walked in the door.
Okay. There's a certain member of Congress. Actually, I'll tell you who it is. Dennis Kucinich has been spending a lot of time in Washington State. He is considering a run for the newly created Washington 10th District.
Wow. You are kidding.
I have it on good authority that Dennis Kucinich has been eyeing several newly created liberal congressional districts. The one he has his eyes set on most is the new Washington 10th District, which would be out in the Olympic Range, out by Olympia. He feels that that is so liberal that even he can get elected there, even as a carpetbagger.
I'll tell you. Jim Over.
I'm going to be calling you, Al, for some political contributions very soon.
Hold on, Rob. What was that, Al?
I said over Jim McDermott's dead body. Jim McDermott really cherishes his position as the most liberal member of the Washington State delegation. He doesn't want any competition.
I thought that you would get a kick out of that.
I do.
Al?
I do.
Does he have a chance?
No. talk about carpetbaggers. I mean, this is more of a purse. You know,
remember, I'll be civil.
Yes, but it's. I remember there was an election on an issue. It was term limits, and the people for it brought in Jerry Brown from California to tell us what we should do, and it is one of the few times in the United States where term limits was defeated. and it was largely because Californians aren't going to tell us what to do.
Right. Well, here's the question for you. When you have an independent redistricting commission out in Washington State,
yes, yes,
which you touted numerous times on this show and mm-hmm. in past shows, does the fact that Dennis Kucinich is eyeing this, does this not beg the question, should we not go back to a legislative redistricting?
No, it does not. I think this is silly season has come early, I think.
it's going to be interesting out there in Washington
yes.
State.
And I'd like to see whether they can form a second solidly Democratic district out there. The area you talk about is very liberal, but it's also not high, it's not as populated as Seattle, which is where Jim McDermott is from.
Right.
I should have mentioned he's the congressman
from Seattle.
Seattle area.
Right.
And as in most states, the largest city is the center of liberal activism.
Correct.
In Washington State. To go down to Olympia, which is a very much smaller area with much less population, I don't know how they can carve out one that would be a surefire bet for somebody as liberal as Kucinich, even if he were somebody from the state.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting. You know, I knew I was going to get a good reaction out of you on that one. I got the reaction I was hoping for. It's going to be interesting out there in Washington State. Just out of curiosity, you know, we look at the states that are going to be gaining. Washington's going to be getting their 10th congressional district. There are states that are going to be losing, namely Ohio, Michigan, possibly Illinois. I don't think that decision has been made. Ralph, are you familiar with any of the other states that might be losing?
New York is losing. I think California is staying the same for the first time. It's not gaining any.
Yeah, and I think that I think that's going to call it a question. The question it begs is: some of your more seasoned statesmen in Congress right now could have their districts redistricted in or merged, particularly in Ohio, and your good friend.
And look at Iowa. You're going to see a very tough race between Tom Latham and Leonard Boswell.
Yeah.
Tom Latham has a lot of money, a lot of backing from the D.C. establishment. And, of course, Boswell has union ties. It's coming up in a year that Obama's on the ballot. Iowa is a very strong state for Obama. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how that race works out.
And Justin just mentioned Michigan, and he said my friend
John Dingell,
and I'm very happy to call him my friend. He was thrown in to a race against another incumbent once before, and
it was brutal. That was a brutal race, if I recall.
It was, and he won it walking away. He's much older. He's in his 80s. His mind is just as sharp as it ever was. His body, he's crippled with arthritis.
Right.
But he's an enormous power. And
Can John Dingell survive another incumbent, the incumbent race?
It would depend on the incumbent.
Does he want to?
And I wish I knew the answer to that. John, I think, wouldn't know what to do with himself if he wasn't in Congress. He gets up every morning with the same enthusiasm for the job that a first-termer does. He's
right.
Just amazing that way. And he's one of the very best legislators that we've seen.
Absolutely, absolutely. The other rumor we've heard is that John Dingell may not want to go through the incumbent race. The name we're hearing, believe it or not, is Debbie Dingell.
That has been going floating around for the last 10 years at least, that she wants to replace John when he decides to give it up. So far, he's not given her the opportunity.
Do you think that's a possibility?
I think if he does not run, it is a definite possibility. I think she would like to do it very much. So if he doesn't win, then I think she would step into it. There's also been the rumor that his son, who's a state legislator, is interested in it as well. So that might make for...
That's going to make for an interesting Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
I'll wishbone fight you for the district. That's awesome. Last couple of minutes here on the show. Want to give our thoughts and our prayers to the folks out in the Mississippi River Valley. They're going through some really tough times right now. I urge everybody who's listening, if you have the opportunity, give the American Red Cross, give to the Salvation Army, give to one of the humanitarian charities. A lot of focus has been put on them with what happened in the tsunami in Japan. I think now it's time we bring it home, and we tend not to give as much when it happens here stateside, and they got a real tough situation going down there, so I urge you to give if you can. Also, I urge you to check out our website, www.firstcongress.org. We've got a couple of speeches, I think, coming up here in the National Capital Region. We'll make some announcements of that coming up. And then in the next couple of weeks, we're going to have some guests that we'll be announcing on the air. And then the other breaking news is apparently we are now going to be a featured show on Blog Talk Radio. So we're going to be pretty excited about that. So that's pretty much it from here in Shelley's back room. Al, any last thoughts?
I have totally emptied my mind of all thoughts.
Ralph, any last thoughts from out there in the great state of Hawaii?
Just having a wonderful time and thinking of you guys. I'm giving you a big hug through the phone and look forward to seeing you in about a week or so.
Good. When are you going to the G8, Ralph?
That's going to be May 23rd, I leave.
Okay,
so,
and you'll be at the G8 when we have our show, so hopefully you'll be able to give us some reports and get some intel for us.
Yes, I don't think I can call in when I'm there, but I can definitely give an updated report when I get back for our next show. Should be very exciting.
Excellent, excellent. We're looking forward to it. Okay, on behalf of Congressman Al Swift, Dr. Ralph Winnie, our member in absentia, the Honorable Bob Hines, I'm your moderator, Justin Russell. We'll be back here at Chili's Back Room next Tuesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, live on Blog Talk Radio. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in Washington, D.C. Stay with us, and we look forward to hearing from you all soon. Take care. Have a great week.